Welcome to episode 41 of Island CT Podcast,
a podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick, and together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
Okay, administration stuff, or administrative stuff, I should say. We're recording this on July 31st, a little late, but we are here and ready to go.
Yeah, so I didn't take notes on administrative stuff. We've been really busy since the Bear Island thing, and before that. We've been away part of every weekend. I've had to work late a couple nights to catch up on work.
And I'm just doing crazy household things that need to be done.
Yeah. Well, the website hasn't been updated since before Bear Island. We're like three or four blog entries late. Like, I have some, and the last two podcasts even haven't been up. The first one was processed, and then the second one hasn't even, I haven't processed, or maybe I processed it, but I haven't listened to it to take notes yet. So hopefully I get to that this week, which means if anyone's listening to this, it's probably like a week or two after July 31st.
Right.
But we're still doing it. I mean, we're not too late in the recording. It's only three or four days late, so that's happens a lot.
And I think we're about to get back into our stride.
Yeah, well, we have a lot coming up.
We do.
We have, you're going to be away for a week. And we have an ARDF meet with the Orienteering Club.
Right.
On August 14th.
Where I get to participate.
Yep. That'll be cool.
So very excited.
And I'm super busy with other stuff, like building equipment and trying to make materials available for some other people, which is really cool.
I was just about to say, and setting up good collaborations, and that takes time.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I mean, I really haven't even started with that until just today. So I promised some people some stuff. And I started the testing. But anyway, so let's move on.
Okay.
We're just really busy with stuff. And, you know, I mean, that's the point, is that it's the stuff we do that's important. And then Island Creative Time is just there to talk about what we're doing and stuff. But what's important is the activities.
Oh, yeah.
So so it's good that we're busy this way.
Yeah.
Yeah, so let's go with what we have.
Okay.
Do you have anything?
So
I want to start with?
Yeah, sure. So I will start with evolution one. And it's on the Rethinking the North American Wolf. And it's from the July 29th, 2016 issue in Science. And
July 29th. You know, I downloaded it. No, there it is. I wanted to read it, but I never got around to it.
It caught my eye, and I have to say it was pretty cool. So what they've done two studies, and they're looking to see, you know, the relationship between the North American wolf and the coyote, and seeing how closely related they are. And although they knew that they were related, they were kind of surprised with the findings about just how closely related they are. And so the study showed that there's mixed ancestry is common even in animals in Western United States, where we've traditionally identified them as pure. And it shows how outdated the endangered species policy is with respect to hybrids. So it was just an interesting article. It's going to make people rethink how we are looking at endangered species, and also taking a closer look at the wolf-coyote hybrids. The wolf-coyote the wolf and coyote population split around the from the Eurasian time, and their lineages seem to be between 6,000 and 117,000 years old, which is much younger than what they thought, because originally they thought that they were over a million years, you know, they had diverged from this one species a million years ago. And so this is much less time. This is done through
6,000
a genomic
is
study.
Nothing.
Yeah.
That's like
right.
3,000 BC.
And that's what has a lot of people worried because, you know, okay, so.
Well, not 3,000. 4,000 BC.
Yeah. And so.
After agriculture started. Anyway.
Right. And then there were different factors in their history that has also driven the populations to be much closer together. For example, I guess initially in North America, the heavy hunting of wolves caused the wolf-coyote hybridization to occur. And they found that in Canada, in one of the studies they did in Quebec, 32%, so in the Algonquin wolves have 32% of coyote ancestry. And then in Quebec wolves have 50%. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's.
And they think this is because of, you know, the heavy hunting, habitat loss, and as people were moving in to North America. So.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was a surprising study. Well, there's two that have backed each other, confirmed what the other is saying. And they just said that, you know, when you have natural biology and or natural histories, they become really muddy to putting, you know, how they are legally accepted as unique species. And so,
right,
you know,
and you have 50% coyote
right.
in your genome.
Yeah.
They were sequencing wolves.
Yeah. And they use many, let's see. So, the team sequenced the whole genome, nearly 3 billion bases each, 28 large candids. They included wolves from Asia, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, plus coyotes, domesticated dogs, and a golden jackal. So they looked at the sequences of all and really tried to separate them out. So it's neat that fossil records showed 1 million years ago, but when we got down to the genome, it put it actually much closer.
Right.
So, neat study. Just it kind of intrigued me.
Cool. I wish I'd read that one. Anyway, anything else along the same lines?
Well, I thought maybe you could take one.
You want to do stick with biology, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think you've seen this. There's usually I only go with the published articles. This mm-hmm. This was posted on the Science website not long ago, so I don't have a good reference, but it was the seal.
Oh, I have it.
Yeah.
Just in case you went to it.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't get a chance to read it, but it didn't.
So let me see. It says July 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it made it in the... It was posted July 22nd.
Right.
On the
right.
Science website. Yeah, so basically it's this research that started to pick up having to do with humpback whales attacking killer whales in situations where the killer whales are attacking a different species, like a third species.
Mm-hmm.
And it started with this one researcher, I think his name is Pittman.
Yes, he's it from, is Robert Pittman.
Okay, so he's...
marine ecologist.
Yeah, he's down in San Diego, I think. Mm-hmm. And he witnessed this this event where a seal was on an ice floe, mm-hmm. and some killer whales were coming up, and it was a typical situation, I guess, where they swim together to create this huge bow wave, and then the wave hits the ice floe.
I think you have to explain how they swim together, because when I...
The video we
yes.
saw? Yes. I don't think the video was of that event, so I don't okay. know if it's always the same.
I went on yeah. YouTube and was looking at different killer whale attacks.
Yeah.
These guys
look I mean, it looks
like
coordinated.
Military yeah. coordination. It looks like, it's like, oh my goodness, they yeah. are moving in a front, and it's like, you see five fins come
all
out
come
of the water.
Together.
And there's a bit of a push of water that they're able to, you know,
yeah,
to push in front of them as they go through. It's
impressive.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's scary.
But. Yeah, you wouldn't mm-hmm. want to be in front of them.
No. But to see it in that kind of...
Yeah, I had the same reaction when I first saw it. I was like, is this fake? I mean,
yes.
This seems like...
It looked like someone set
so
up
coordinated.
A visual of, you know, just
yeah.
to entertain
anyway,
us.
Anyway,
yeah.
so this one event, the seal got knocked off the ice floe, and two humpback whales showed up, mm-hmm. and one of them was swimming on its back,
right,
and the seal got pushed up onto the humpback whale's chest,
mm-hmm.
and it arched its back to keep its chest out of the water with the seal on it so the killer whales couldn't get to it.
I know, but you see, what I find so surprising
yeah.
is these are mammals. They need to breathe. So the whole time it's arching its back, it can't come up for a breath.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it just, that I was just amazed by.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess when the seal started to fall off, then it would take its flipper
mm-hmm.
and push it back up.
Yeah.
And then it got close to another ice floe, and the seal scrambled up onto that and was safe. And so you thought, well, this is kind of interesting and really surprising. And he put up a request for more information on some listserv mm-hmm. about mammals somewhere, I think marine mammals, and got all of these responses, some of them including pictures and videos
mm-hmm.
about humpback whales attacking. I mean, it really looks like they're actively offensive, in an offensive posture. In these videos and interactions
mm-hmm.
that you can guess what's happening from pictures, you know, against killer whales. And in those where the target, the killer whale, the animal that the killer whale was targeting, in 90% of those where it could be identified,
mm-hmm.
it was not a humpback whale calf.
Mm-hmm.
Because humpback whales are not attacked by killer whales as adults.
Right.
But their calves are, and they'll
right.
they'll defend their calves strenuously.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
it's.
I will put in that the video that he's referring to is humpback whales attempt to stop killer whale attack -planet Earth Live, and I think that is a YouTube video as well.
Video by the BBC.
Oh, sorry, video by the BBC show. Humpback whales.
Yeah. So it's probably on YouTube.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and there's, you know, it raises questions about altruism and what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think, I mean, his conclusion was, as a tentative hypothesis, that simply they have so much, the humpback whales have so much experience with killer whale attacks on the calves. Basically, they've come to this situation where whenever they hear humpback whales attacking, killer whales attacking anything, they just go there and try to break it up. That's his
right.
theory.
Right.
With the idea that you know, it's like an enemy species type thing, mm-hmm. and they're going to...
You know what I'm using it as?
What's
in
that?
In school. So after you told me the story, yeah. I made a slide for our, like, you know, we have to teach character ed. So for responsibility, I have the killer whale and the humpback whale defending the seal.
Cool. Okay. Do you have other biology type stuff?
I do. Okay. I have one that's more of parasitology.
Okay.
But it was so much fun. It was a very short article.
Also?
Yes, it is. Okay. And it's one of their news articles, so it's very short. Uh-huh. I think it was only a paragraph or two. And it was called Sickness on the Silk Road, July 29th, in Science News. And it was just... Oh, sorry. It was Science, our News at a Glance section of the article, or of the... journal you didn't get to. Anyway, they were looking at the parasites, the fossilized parasites that were found in the intestines and human excrements.
Mm-hmm.
And the information they're getting is incredible, because they're noticing not only the transmission of diseases and how widespread some diseases traveled just because of human contact. And one of them, said this one disease, it must have originally have been picked up by travelers in modern day Guangdong province, some 2,000 kilometers away. So to think of just... the population that was traveling that road and sure. the diversity and just it, you know, it just is mind boggling.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was neat that they're using parasitology to find all of this.
Yeah, I totally missed. Yeah. I totally missed that one.
Yeah. It was very small and it was in News at a Glance section.
I see the Chinese liver fluke.
Yeah.
That's got to be nasty.
Yeah.
So, flatworm, yeah. endemic marshy areas.
And apparently they use these hygiene sticks, like bamboo sticks.
Yeah, I saw the stuff you copied.
And it's these sticks that have been preserved.
Right, it says here they got sent to a museum, right. and then and people forgot about them.
And so I love how these things that are lost in drawers at museums are finally discovered, and there's these cool studies that come out of them. Anyway.
Okay. Me?
Yep.
Stick with bio?
Sure.
I only have one non-biology one.
Okay. I have one non-biology one too.
This one you might... I don't think you've seen. Have you ever heard of honey hunters?
No.
So in Africa, there's a bird called the greater honey guide.
Mm-hmm.
And different places in Africa, different tribes, have individuals that are specialized honey hunters.
Oh, how cool.
And they'll have this call. And this one group in, I can't remember where, I think it's Mozambique. Yes. So they have this, their call is, I can't remember, I think it's a trill and then a grunt. And they make this call, and supposedly this bird shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And they follow the bird, and the bird shows them where there's a bee nest, right?
Yeah.
And then, so they get the honey, and then the bird goes after the wax after the honey hunter is done.
Mm-hmm.
And so this researcher wanted to see, well, you know, how much is this folklore and how much is this real? And he played back the sounds from this tribe. I think they're the Yao,
mm-hmm.
Y-A-O. Yao Honey Hunters, Mozambique. And he played back either a song from a dove of some kind, of course, the trill grunt that the Yao use, and another Yao call that's totally unrelated. And let me see, they have here 66% of the time a bird would show up if there was that trill grunt call. And 81% of the time after that bird showed up, or 81% of those times when they followed the bird, they found a bee's nest at the end.
Wow.
Now, the other calls, half as often did a bird ever show up. Mm-hmm. So 33%. And of those, almost never did they lead them to, right?
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And they have a picture. Oh, by the way, this is from the July 22nd issue of Science. It's on page 335. They have a picture of one of these greater honey guides. Mm-hmm.
And he has just a wonderful smile. He just...
Well, this is... The guy is the honey hunter.
Oh, sorry.
And the greater honey guide is the bird.
Yeah, the bird, yeah. Sorry.
So there's going to be some more research. There's another group called the Hadza in Tanzania, and they use a totally different call. No one's ever done research on them, and presumably there's other groups.
Nice.
And there's a real big question here, because... So different groups have different calls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do these birds know? Well, you figure, oh, that's simple. They are in the region, right?
Right.
And it's like other birds. They grew up, they learn their calls from their parents, and and they learn how to recognize calls by following their parents around and so on and so forth. Except the greater honey guide is like the cuckoo. It lays its nest in another species' nest.
Oh.
So the birds are raised by the wrong species.
Oh, wow.
So how do they know?
Yeah.
To come to the call of the honey hunter.
Right.
Which is different in one place versus another.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the species is spread over large areas of Africa. So it's a really curious thing. And
yes.
It's really sad in a way, because with increasing urbanization and changes in lifestyle, a lot of the traditional lifestyles,
right,
you get fewer and fewer people. Mm-hmm. So you have fewer and fewer that know even how to make this call or even practice.
Yeah.
And you can imagine the greater honey guide will stop to have this connection with humans.
Yeah. Yeah. So that connection may also die out over time. Yeah.
But it's, I don't know, it's just really cool.
It is.
It's a mutualistic
relationship
between humans and birds.
Oh, that is so cool.
You know, with this one species.
Yeah. 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 Oh, that is really neat.
So, do you have any?
I do not have any more biology ones. I have one on the ocean circulation change.
So, I have one more biology maybe before.
Okay, how about you do that?
And then
one.
I have a physical sciences type one. Yeah, it's about this, the loss of mitochondrial DNA from the father in an offspring. And
Mother takes over. Yeah.
It's on July 22nd. So, you know, I'm not going to go into any depth about the research, which is getting into the mechanism about how this happens, and it's getting pretty complicated. But just this one particular fact that comes out, which is, you know, the way I usually thought about it, and I think the way it's been taught to us for a long time, even after we learned about it. I mean, you might still, I don't know if you go over this with fertilization and meiosis and so on, but generally I was taught, well, the sperm hits the egg, dumps the genetic material in there, and the rest of the sperm, you know, behind the head, basically is lost.
Right.
So you have this sheath around the sperm tail. It's full of mitochondria. That's just gone.
Sloughed off.
Not true.
Oh.
that ends up, those mitochondria end up in the egg. Aha, so that's interesting, mm-hmm. because the reason we're always told, the reason you get all of your genetic material, you know, there's this whole study on human mm-hmm. evolution looking at mitochondrial DNA,
right.
because we know that has to come from the mother only.
Right.
So it's purely just you're tracing the maternal lineage.
Mm-hmm.
No, those mitochondria from the sperm end up in the egg. And with other species, that's the case. Lower species, I think insects and other things. Let me see. I think it's C. elegans that has, yeah. So it has here C. elegans, spermatozoids, are amoeboid cells.
Mm-hmm.
And they fuse.
Right.
So there it's obvious that everything's going to be mixed together. But even in them, all of the male mitochondria are destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And the pathway that's used, there basically seems to be a label of those mitochondria ahead of time, before fertilization. And in some species, even before fertilization occurred, they started to get destroyed.
Right.
But most of them, I think they get destroyed after fertilization.
Mm-hmm.
They're just marked.
Right.
So you have this mixture for a short while in the ova with maternal and paternal mitochondria, but all the paternal ones are marked for death. And it's the same pathway that's used for, should we say, autophagy? Should we say?
So.
I'm just going to decide on autophagy. Anyway, where you envelop the mitochondrion with a membrane, fuse it with lysosomes, and you just mm-hmm. chew it up. And it has to do with the loss of the membranes inside the mitochondria, and the inner membrane allows a lot of the enzymes that are in the that space between the two membranes
mm-hmm.
to enter inside and just chew it apart. Anyway, so yeah, it's really
Here's something weird that I was just thinking, maybe not connected. So you'll have to say no.
Sure, sure.
Okay. So you remember when we were looking into CRISPR?
Yeah.
And they were using that to create organisms with the gene that would kill all of the male or...
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I'm Thank wondering you. If there's a similar undiscovered network like that going, where there's some kind of...
The autophagy whole mechanism is really well understood.
Okay.
I think what's... Okay. And we can... And the research that I said I'm not going to go into, there's labeling of the mitochondria with protein modifications that match what happens in autophagy. So this is not, you know,
it's not
the question is what causes it to happen in the steps before that, and also why?
Well, I'm thinking protein synthesis has to be, you know, like, okay, so those proteins are responsible for triggering the autophagy.
Yeah.
They're something that was there so that, you know.
They're there ahead of time.
They're there ahead
of time. To be ready to go, yeah. I think the bigger question is why. And mm-hmm. it looks like if you know, all of the genetic material in the mitochondria is the same in every person. And it seems like if you have two different sets and they're supposed to coordinate with one nuclear genome,
mm-hmm.
then that causes problems.
Oh, I see.
Right. But I mean, that's not a good enough explanation for me.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, you mix the two genomes of the male and the female,
mm-hmm.
and at least even in the woman, at least, you have different cells depending on which X chromosomes get inactivated, right? That's the famous, mm-hmm. I think, Lyons hypothesis. Well, I mean, it's not a hypothesis anymore. We know that's how it happens. So it seems like, I just don't understand why it's so important.
Mm-hmm.
But But it has implications directly for some medical practices that are happening right now, because they talked about some approval that's gone ahead for doing triple parent in vitro fertilization, just to test to see how to get around some diseases that are associated with mitochondria. So basically, normal in vitro fertilization, you have male donates sperm, and woman donates the ova, they're fertilized, and then re-implanted in. Well, what if the woman has a genetic disease and her mitochondria, there's something wrong with
them?
They're
defective.
Yeah. But they still want to have a child. So what's just been approved, I think it's going ahead. It's just research to see, you provide the sperm from the male, you extract the nucleus from the mother, from the mother's ovum, you implant both the sperm and that nuclear from the mother into a third person's ova, another woman. That woman, the nucleus from her cell has been removed, but it has the healthy mitochondria.
I understood that is actually being done in Britain.
Yeah, right, I think.
And because I remember reading an article like a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, about three parent child, or, you know.
So what they say here is, you're right, US and UK science and ethics panels gave limited approval to preventing these diseases by in vitro fertilization with nuclear transfer using genetic material from three parents.
Mm-hmm.
Sperm, father, oocyte, mother, oocyte nucleus mother, and oocyte cytoplasm from second female. Recent experiments. Yeah, so these recent experiments they talk about next, seems like there's going to be a problem.
Oh,
and the reason because is that the mitochondrial DNA from the second woman doesn't match the nuclear DNA from the nucleus from the mother. Doesn't match. What does that mean? Well, they're different, of course, but there's an incompatibility there. But I mean, that's
it's
curious.
I
don't understand.
Very interesting.
It's
going to
be very interesting to see where that leads.
Okay,
I think we are totally done with all of our biology.
Okay, I have one called The Smoking Gun, The Atlantic Circulation Changes.
Smoking Gun.
And it's from Science, the 29th of July.
Got it.
2016. So this one talks about the meridional overturn, or the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. And it's looking at that and how it changes during the most recent ice ages. And what they found is, from two independent records that there's been, that they've looked at, the AMOC of our present system has been changing, and the flow patterns are starting to change, and they're looking at it as in, wow, you know, what is this to say about our current climate changes, and how, you know, what can we expect? And
so wait a second, the MAOC, that's, so in the Atlantic, that's the Gulf Stream that goes north?
Yeah.
And then there must be one going south. Oh, the Labrador Current, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they looked at all the records, and they call them from Theta O, and it's the Asgard Oscar records, or events, I should say. And they found that in all these ice ages, or the precursor to the Ice Age. There's prompt warming and cooling of the North Atlantic and more gradual temperature changes at the opposite end in the Antarctic. And their model suggests that the rapid transition between the AMOC states can be triggered by freshwater fluxes. And the reason when I read that, I was like, oh, Greenland.
So that's what came in.
And so I was like, whoa. Yeah. Okay. Which could cause observed changes in surface temperatures.
Yeah. Although, I think Greenland, not just because of how much ice is there, but because of the fact that the North Atlantic is small compared.
Right.
Like, there's this worry about these huge mm-hmm. ice shelves mm-hmm. in detaching in the Antarctic. But of course, you've got this huge current going around the Antarctic,
right.
which will mix everything pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the dumping of Greenland water ends up basically right there in the
right.
North Atlantic.
Right. It's also in the study they say, but we need more evidence from the deep sea and looking at the, and that could help them reconstruct the paleo-oceanic reconstructions. And so one of the proxies they use were two radioisotopes, protactinium and thorium, and they also used carbon isotopes to look at this study. And they're, it's just one more place where they're able to patch together models that may help us understand climate change.
So, where are they? They're doing cores like bottom sediments?
Yes.
Because I see they're bottom dwelling foraminifera.
Yeah. Right.
They're basically analyzing the composition
mm-hmm.
of in those sediments.
Right.
Okay. Got it.
Right.
Yeah, interesting but complicated stuff. But like those isotope changes and what they reveal, because it's not just. It's like how they sediment differentially.
Right.
And how the changes in temperature causes different elements to be incorporated by the biology.
So I'm assuming we'll see more about this in the future. And it's very interesting just looking at climate change from many different angles.
Yeah.
Like from... some of the studies use similar proxies, but they're looking at very different perspective.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what's the significance of, the AMOC changes, that's one thing, but the total collapse, it's be curious to see, well, what does that mean exactly?
Right.
If you don't get this interchange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's hard for me to conceptualize. Okay, well, that's all I have.
So my physical sciences one?
Yep.
So this is from July 29th issue again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this relatively long article for a news piece
mm-hmm.
about, it really goes into a lot of detail about all of the exoplanet information that's coming out in the last, decade or so, and how basically every new piece of information goes against every current theory, and the modelers try to race to explain it, and the next piece of information is from, new technology in terms of seeing what exoplanets are there.
Mm-hmm.
Destroys all the theories again, and every time we can push the boundary a little bit further back, stuff we can see, we get data that is really unusual. So, for example, well, what's the basic? The basic situation at the start is we were looking at our system and we came up with these models and total made sense because we're looking at just one system and it's well established. In this system, you have basically planets being made by what's called core accretion. Mm-hmm. So you have this huge area with lots of gas and it's got dust in it. And because it's slightly higher density, it starts to collapse on itself. Mm-hmm. And everything has some kind of a little bit of angular momentum. So it spins as it collapses. And just mm-hmm. like, you know, the typical example of this type of thing, the ice skater drawing its hands in, it speeds up, right? So you end up with all of this gas falling into the center. And when it gets hot enough from the pressure going up, you get nuclear fusion starting. Mm-hmm. You get a star forming. And it's spinning. And all of the gas around it is spinning, and it forms this disk. And then at different places along this disk, you have areas that coalesce and form planets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There is a zone close to the star in which the heat from the star is going, and from the, maybe even just the gas falling in, I don't know, is going to make it too hot for the gases to condense.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that zone, and they call the edge of it the snow line, excuse me, planets will form by little grains of dust mm-hmm. sticking to each other until you get bodies that are about a kilometer or more in size, and then they start banging into each other, and now it's not electrostatic attraction anymore that causes stuff to stick. It's actually gravity that causes them to bang into each other, and they form planets.
Mm-hmm.
And because the gas in this region is too hot to condense, you get formation of rocky planets like Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. So that all makes sense, right? Because that's what we see here. And their atmosphere is really tenuous. So I don't know if you've seen, like, to scale a cross section of the Earth and its atmosphere. It's like a really, really thin thing compared to, think, Jupiter that's got this huge atmosphere. Okay. So that's why you get rocky inner planets. Also, you're close to the sun, which means you're going around fast.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So normally, you'd pick up a lot of gas. And because the gas is not condensing, that's why you don't get it. On the outside of the snow line, the very first planet you get, it's going to be going around pretty fast
mm-hmm.
because it's so pretty close, but the gases can condense. So very quickly, you'll form this planet, and it's got all of this gas, like Jupiter. And it's going to be huge because it's going around fast, and it's gobbling up all this gas. And then a little bit further out, you'll get another gas giant because, mm-hmm. again, the gases can condense because it's cold out there.
Mm-hmm.
But as you get further out, it goes slower. So it takes, since it's going around slowly, it's going to pick up less gas because it's not, you know, hitting it as fast or whatever.
Right.
And while they're forming, at the same time, you have the solar wind coming from your star pushing the gas away.
Mm-hmm.
So it only has a certain amount of time, I don't know how many million years, before all of the gas is pushed out of the solar system to the outer edges, you know, past Pluto. Type mm-hmm. of distances for a sun like ours.
Mm-hmm.
So the modelers started to model all different ways solar system would form, and every single time they came up with a whole bunch of rocky planets with almost no atmosphere, then a giant gas planet just outside of the snow zone, right?
So it's
then a smaller gas giant, then a smaller until past Neptune type distances.
I thought there'd be more you don't variety. Get anything.
No, that's what, and so everybody's like, well, that's what everything's like. And then the, you know, the, I don't, I barely remember the first time we were able to identify a planet outside of our solar system, right? That was really amazing. It was what one of those what they call hot Jupiters. In other words, it's the planet the size of Jupiter, or even bigger. It's closer to its sun than even Mercury is here. And it's flying around, like, I think it has, does an orbit every, like, 4 days or something. Wow. It's just insane. And we're finding more and more of these. And it's like, this makes no sense.
Right.
No, no. First of all, there's not even enough gas in there for it to form. It's in an orbit that's nice and circular, so... I can't remember all of the reasons why it makes no sense, right? And then later on, we found some super Earths, they call them. They're rocky planets that are like way bigger than the Earth. Well, that makes no sense because there's just not enough material to form such a huge thing.
Right.
And even if there was, then why didn't it get also a lot of gas?
Right.
It's a super Earth because it doesn't have gas. And then you have other planets that are humongous, many times the size of Jupiter, way out past Pluto. And, you know, all these discoveries came one after the other. And every time you had models that were changed to try to explain this one thing. How do you get hot Jupiters to form? Okay,
right.
Like, you know, we think we have a couple theories, right? And
then
these totally did not predict the very next finding, which might be, I can't remember the order, but it was maybe like super Earths.
Right.
And then came those other super Jupiters way,
right,
way out where there shouldn't even be any formation of planets at all.
Right.
And then, you know, ours form always in these nice disks, and we're finding planets that go around in all sorts of crazy orbits. And so... yeah, this is, we're going to find lots of interesting research. And the thing is, every few years, like every 5 years or so, there's a new spacecraft or a new telescope that's planned that's going to tell us even more, to give us more data about.
Right.
And the interesting thing is, right now, there's basically two ways we look for them. There's the gravitational effect of the planet on the star. So you look at us, I think that they didn't explain this, but I think basically you look at the star with an interferometer and you see if it red shifts or blue shifts. And if you see that, you're measuring the tug of a big planet.
Right.
So for that to, in order to be able to see that, it's got to be a really big planet.
Right.
And then the other way is the transit of a planet across the face of the sun. And there the sun, so a big planet, the the interferometer system, I think that's for mostly planets that are far. No, both that and the transit are for ones that are close. And then now we have direct imaging. And direct imaging, you can only see planets that are very far. Because if you go too close to you look too close to the star, you've got too much light to contend with directly from the star. So there's this huge area in between where we have no data. We have data about planets that are very close and planets that are very far, but nothing in between. And so that'll help with the theories. Anyway, it's a really fascinating article. And it's really exciting to have all of this research planned.
I looked at the, I didn't, I wanted to read it.
Yeah.
I looked at the name and was like, I want to go back.
It's
to
on,
yeah.
It's July 29th issue, page 439.
Yeah. I did notice that one.
They have some
that
interesting
was one
graphs.
That I wanted to see and didn't get to. Yeah. Neat. I'm looking forward to reading it.
I think that is it for today. Future plans, and if you're going to be away. We have artists on August 14th.
Yeah.
I have a friend, Charles Charlot, who's taken the code. So I've been working a lot with the SI-5351. And I tried to get the code to work for the 2-meter transmitters and had some problems. And I think I got it to work with the Arduino library from Jason Meldrum, but not the AVR library, which is the one that we need to use. Anyway, Charles Charlo took it and sent me some files. And nice. And he thinks he ported the Arduino code into the AVR library. Nice. So I put the whole rig together on my desk this morning, mm-hmm. and I got it compiling again and putting the firmware onto the 80 mega this morning and measured an output of just a few megahertz and got the wave on the oscilloscope. So that all worked. And so I'm really excited to put on Charles's. I mean, I've been wanting to do this for so long, but we've been so busy. Anyway, I wish I'd done it so we could talk about it, but
that's okay.
In another half hour, or maybe, well, within the next couple hours, I'll probably.
Right.
No.
Okay.
Ardiff on August 14th. Do we have anything else? Oh, we had done some climbing.
Oh, yeah. We've been out climbing. Top roping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. It's been a lot of fun to get back to it.
And yeah.
To start to use muscles that you had forgotten about.
And this summer, we really had to cut back on that.
Yeah.
But we said we were going to do it, and really, out of desperation, we were just about a month ago said, okay, we need to plan these because you can't afford to lose it too much if you have plans like we do. So
nice.
Yep.
It's nice to get back to that.
Are we good?
Yeah, I think we're all done.
Okay, so... thank you for listening to the Island CET podcast.
Make sure and check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.